Welcome to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by Scientific Triathlon and hosted by me, Michael Eriksson. Today I'm joined by Stephen Barrett, who is a cycling coach from Ireland, working as the head coach of the UCI World Tour team Decathlon Alpe d'Huez Le Mondial, and he's also coaching several of the riders on the team personally, including GC contender Felix Gall, who was fifth in this year's Tour de France. We start with a bit of a look into the inner workings of the coaching setup of a World Tour team, and then from there we move on to a detailed deep dive into training methods, training principles in typical TTS fashion. We'll get right into the interview after thanking our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. And some big and exciting news dropped just a couple of days ago, which is PFNH are now the global hydration partners of Ironman in 2026, meaning that you'll have the PH1000 electrolyte drink as the on-course hydration product at all Ironman and 73 events globally, including the world champs in Nice and Kona. And this is fantastic news for all athletes racing Ironman-branded races, as it makes it so much easier to meet your electrolyte needs in particular. And the best thing is that you can use the free fuel and hydration planner on precisionfuelandhydration.com to get a hydration strategy tailored not just for you as an athlete and your typical sweat rate and sweat sodium concentration, but actually for the specific race you're doing. And this includes all Ironman 73 races globally. So, for example, you'll get a different hydration plan for a cooler race like Oceanside compared with a hot and humid race like Kona. And you can select in the planner which race you're doing and get an exact hydration plan for that one. So check it out. And as a TTS listener, remember that you can get 15% off of all Precision Fuel Hydration products by using the code TTS2025 on precisionfuelhydration.com. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Stephen Barrett. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Stephen. How are you?
Very good. Thanks, Mikael. Nice to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. Can you start with an introduction? Tell us more about yourself and your current role, as well as a bit of your background.
Yes, of course. So my name is Stephen Barrett. Currently, I am the head coach for Decathlon AG Tour Le Mondial cycling team. I suppose I've held this role for the last 2 years in the role as head coach. I've worked in the team since the end of 2018, so coming on to 8 years, which is quite some time. Yeah, I've got my background really has been working as a coach within the World Tour now for almost 11 years. So reasonably experienced now, I would say. Prior to this, I was, as many coaches, a kind of a somewhat average, somewhat failed athlete. I was originally a football player many years ago when I grew up in Ireland and transitioned into triathlon when I realized, yeah, that I had an aptitude for cycling and running. And realized quickly I wasn't the best swimmer. So that's kind of, I had a short stint in triathlon for a couple of years and then transitioned across to cycling, where I was, yeah, again, had a decent level, raced at a continental level. I had a bad crash in 2011. And from there, kind of went back and finished off my academic studies. I had a degree and a master's in sports physiology and nutrition, and was a university lecturer for quite a few years prior to going full into the world of sport since 2018. So it's a little bit about me.
How did you make that jump from university, from the academic world, to getting a role in the World Tour?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's something I often reflect on, because for me, the dream job was being a teacher or a lecturer. I mean, I love the idea of learning about new concepts and then teaching young coaches, students about how the body works, or about how to coach in the elite side of sport. Got my dream job and was there for 4 or 5 years. And after 4 or 5 years, felt I became a bit stagnant, that every year was the same. You know, each module was the same. There was some year-on-year development, but generally speaking, it was the same thing each year, which I enjoyed, but yeah, I felt I was probably only working at, you know, 50-60% of my capacity. I felt I could offer more. So I got involved in just doing some local coaching with some amateur riders back in 2015, 2016. And that kind of led on to, yeah, working with some good amateurs and getting to a good national level. And in 2016, I was offered the role as head of performance with Aqua Blue Sport, which at the time was a pro-county cycling team based in Ireland. and I accepted that. And I was triple jobbing. I was working as a sports scientist with a football team. I was lecturing, and I was also head of performance with a pro Conti team, because I enjoyed all three aspects of my work. So lecturing, S&C work, nutrition work, and then working in pro Conti cycling. That team folded after 2 years just for some different financial reasons. And I was happy. I said, okay, I'll take a step back and go back to my lecturing job. I was quite happy to have that experience and had a bit of added chapter to my life. And it was quite funny. I got offered a spot to go to the Science and Cycling Conference, which is before the Tour de France in Nantes in 2018, which is where the Tour de France started. And I was like, wow. I was asked to go and give a presentation about how we could maximize performance with a small budget, or with a modest budget we had in Aquablue Sport. And I was kind of, I was not super keen to go. I had a lot of travel that summertime, and my wife said, look, just go. You know, it will be fun. You'll spend a few days in Nantes, see the South Tour de France and see what happens. Went to Nantes and gave a presentation at the Science and Cycling Conference. And my current boss, my current boss was in the audience. And he liked what he saw. He was the head of performance at the time with AG Tour Le Mondial. And he offered me a job to come to the team full time. And honestly speaking, AG Tour Le Mondial wasn't a team which would have been at the top of my list to join. Again, just because it was a French team, I spoke zero French. They spoke very little English. Met him. We had a coffee. And yeah, 8 years on, I'm still there. So that was kind of the start of it. Really, it was just off the chance presentation at a conference.
And how's the French now? I know you live in France. You've been there for a while. Is it coming along nicely?
Yeah, it is. Honestly, it's one of the things I said to my wife when I joined the team was, if it all goes pear-shaped or goes wrong after a year or 2 years, you'll pick up a new skill. You'll better speak French. And that's why I was quite motivated to come to the team. It was difficult my first few years. I said, I've been there 8 years now. But honestly, one of the coolest things now is I can fluently speak French. It's something that I never thought I would do when I was in school many years ago. I never liked languages. Now I can speak fluent French, which is, it's cool. You know, it's quite cool to have a second language. My son, who's 5 years old, speaks fluent French. He's in a school in France. And my wife works here in France. So it's, even just from a personal point of view, in my own personal life, I've really kind of, got to have some cool experiences in the team, which has been nice.
Yeah, no, that's excellent. And as the head coach of the team, I want to ask you a bit about what is the structure like for the coaching setup? How many coaches do you have? How does it work with you as a head coach working with the coaches, potentially also working directly with cyclists or them working with cyclists? Can you tell in your own words about how the whole setup works within the team?
Yeah, I think we've been one of those teams which has really been part of, I suppose, the new wave of professional cycling. When I joined the team in 2018, we had three coaches. So we had a head of performance and three coaches. And we were one of the, let's say the first French teams who began to employ more than one or two coaches. I think previously the DSs were kind of involved in that. So that's kind of where we started. And that was one head of performance and three coaches. In the last 8 years, that's really gone to a different level. Now we have a World Tour team where we have six coaches who work across the 28 riders or 30 riders we have. We've a new gen group, which is our combined U19 and Conti team, where we also have three coaches who work within that. So going from one head of performance to three coaches, we now have one head of performance, one head coach, and six, if I'm counting correctly, six full-time coaches in the team. And we also have two S&C coaches. So the ground support in terms of coaching really has gone to another level. We have, like I said, we've got six coaches who coach across the World Tour. We're one of the lucky teams who allows our coaches to coach between 6 to 8 riders maximum. I know in other teams, that number is much, much bigger. What we've found to really have maximum impact, 6 to 7 is that sweet spot where you can really be a coach and you can really give time to the rider to ensure that they're developing at a good rate. In our Conti team, which now comes under the same umbrella as our World Tour team, we've got 13 riders, and we'll have one lead coach and one assistant coach. And with our U19s, we have 15 riders. Again, we'll have one lead coach and again, an assistant coach. And my role as head coach oversees the coaches, but also oversees the general preparation of all the riders. I personally coach 4 athletes, but I oversee then the 28 World Tour, the 13 Conti and the 15 U19 for the last couple of years, which has been challenging, but extremely rewarding as well.
And what does that oversight look like? Is it, or do you have a shared philosophy in some areas, or is it more mentoring without really influencing the style of coaching? Yeah. What does it look like?
That's a real, real good question, because it's something we've worked on, I would say, in the last 2 years, is really developing a group or a coaching group philosophy. So how we do things, not so much dictating the methodology we use, but certainly having a clear philosophy of how we work as a group of coaches. So for me, as head coach, my 2 key priorities are, one, coaching the athletes I coach, and also overseeing the other athletes to ensure they're being well looked after, but really then supporting the coaches as well, especially our younger or less experienced coaches, that we can bring those in. We have weekly group coach meetings. And the idea of that is to create an environment where, you know, we have so much experience in our coach group now. You know, we've got, you know, coaches who've coached Monument winners, Paris-Roubaix winners, Grand Tour winners, you know, pink jerseys in the Giro d'Italia, stage winners, Tour de France. And having an environment where we have 1 or 2 of our younger coaches can be involved in those discussions, ask questions, be challenged, build trust among group, is just really something that we've worked on. So we work really with, you know, we try to create a very much a rider-centered approach. That we're not coach-centered, we're rider-centered. And that allows us to be able to give the responsibility to the riders. We support them. You know, we have an incredibly strong support system from medical, nutrition, sports, management, psychology, coaching, SNC, bike fitting, the list goes on. So the riders really have access to anything that they need. So we make sure they're responsible for their performance. Very much it's performance focused. And the coach will lead a lot of us. So the coach will be the person who can guide, not dictate, can guide the riders in where they need to go and search for support. So very much rider-centered, very much coach-led. And then across the coaches, then we really abide by, I think, 3 key values. The first one really is collaboration. Historically, in the sport, coaches often worked in kind of silos where they were very protective over their information. We really work on a way to collaborate and to share information and to build trust. I found that's the best way for us to move forward as a group. So we work on collaboration, so build trust, challenge each other, but ensure we're always aligned on what the goal or the objectives are. We also try to focus on simplicity. And what I mean by simplicity really is ensuring that we're not complicating things unnecessarily. Yes, there's very some complex things in philosophy, in physiology and nutrition and coaching. But our job as coaches is to ensure we can keep it simple for the riders, because simplicity will often allow, you know, greater adherence. And if you have greater adherence, then you're going to get greater bang for your buck. And then the last one then is what we focus on, is really adaptability. That if no one is a slave to a certain way of doing things, there's not one way to build VO2 max. There's not one way to build durability. There's not one way to build sprint power. So we're not chained to a polarized methodology or a block periodization methodology. We're really trying to open up that we can adapt to what suits the rider the best. So we kind of work off your best practice, good practice, novel practice. So best practice is what the science says is the best thing to do. Sometimes that doesn't work for a rider for a given reason. So we'll then choose a different method. It may be, you know, what we would term as good practice. Maybe not the best in terms of science, but the best for that rider in that context. And you have other things then, like maybe something that's a bit more novel. It's been around, but like torque training, for example, the science is reasonably, I would say, loose on it, but we find it effective in certain scenarios. So we will certainly apply that to certain riders in certain contexts to ensure they're moving forward. So like I said, if I was putting in a nutshell, collaboration, simplicity, that adaptability are 3 things we really abide by as a group of coaches.
Yeah, that's a great summary. So it's really not so much about the I guess, the technical side, the programming, but it's more about the overarching values that lead you to both what you're doing, but even how you're doing it.
Yeah, and that's, to me, as a world tour team, we've got highly qualified coaches. And I'm involved in the recruitment process as well with the coaches. So there is, the coaches within our team have a very in-depth understanding of the physiology and the determinants of performance and the determinants of fatigue and what builds VO2 max and what builds your sprint power. That's a given. But really for us, and as we spoke about before the call, is it's not so much what the riders do, it's how they do it. And we really try to make sure our coaches can really master that way of getting information, package it in a certain way. If you're speaking to a 17-year-old rider, a 20-year-old neo pro, a 35-year-old guy who's been around for a long, long time, the same information, but you have to package it differently so that they understand this and then they can apply it in their context. So that's been really a nice thing for me, is working with riders from different nationalities, from Finnish to American to Australian to Belgian to Dutch to Swiss. Also from 16, 17 years old up to 36, 37, 38 years old and everything in between. And that's kind of where we all have access to the information. The information is there. It's how we deliver that to have its best impact.
And speaking of 16-year-olds and 36-year-olds, since you have those, you have the under-19s and you have the Pro Continental team with underneath the World Tour team, what is the, is there a pathway that you basically have set up and that you facilitate for the young athletes that to help them hopefully or maximize the chances of taking the step to the World Tour?
Yeah, again, really, really good question, I think. So with us, in the last couple of years, we have brought our U19 team under the umbrella of the World Tour team. So we've always had a U19 team for quite some years and a World Tour team. And what we found really was there was a missing step or missing piece of the jigsaw, which really was this stepping stone between U19 to World Tour. And we ended up losing quite a lot of our best U19s because we didn't have a development team or a continental team, which is what we have, it's what we have now. So now we've a three team basically umbrella. We World Tour, and then we got Conti and U19. And really with us, our philosophy with our U19 team is to develop athletes. And the success isn't do they make World Tour or not. The success really is to ensure can they maximize their genetic potential. That's what we're trying to do. And if we can allow the U19s come into our structure, allow them to build and to develop at their own race, then give them the opportunity to come into our Conti team. And with our Conti team, it's quite nice because we're attached to the World Tour team. They'll be exposed to a certain number of U23 races, maybe 1.1, 1.2 races as well, but also can race up to the World Tour team at select periods during the year. So we try and expose, again, U19 is about developing characteristics, determinants of performance. Our Conti team then is about developing skill and developing, exposing them to what racing the World Tour may be like. And then trying to get the step up into World Tour. And we've had a pretty good hit rate, I would say, in the previous years. Riders who maybe didn't step up directly from our Conti team to our World Tour team have stepped up to World Tour team in other teams. But we've had some quite good success stories the last few years. Yeah, you can name a few. Benoit Cosnefroy, Paul Lapierre, the French national champion last year in 2024. We've had, of course, people know Paul Sexus and Leo Bisio as well, Rasmus Pedersen, Oscar Chamberlain. So we've had quite a success rate, and I think it's a critical part for our long term vision with the team.
Is at the U19 level, how do you think that can you predict who will make the step to the World Tour with some level of accuracy, or is it too early and it really isn't something that you can accurately do?
Again, it's something that I've been thinking about a lot, being more involved with mentoring the coaches involved in U19. I think scientifically, and we've all heard of the LTAD model or the long-term elite development, and we know that early specialization doesn't necessarily mean, early career high performance doesn't really necessarily mean future performance. But honestly speaking, I think a lot of the World Tour teams are I won't say part of the problem, but you know, we select the most developed, you know, 17, 18 year olds. You know, that's where it is. There's a bit of when riders or when athletes across all sports, when they specialize early, we know science says there's a greater risk of burnout, a greater risk of injury, a greater risk of dropout. It doesn't, you're not guaranteed future success, but there are exemptions. There are exceptions. And we're looking for those exceptions. And every team will want to go, and you look at the U17, U18 race, and you want to pick out those best riders, bring them into your structure, and then hope they make it. So is there something that you can tell if they're trainable, if they have what's required to make it? I think yes, you can do psychological or different psychological assessments to see, do they have the mental capacity to be able to deal with demands of racing, demands of training, just the general life demands of what it takes to be a World Tour rider. Then you're looking at some of the physiological characteristics. We look for sure, okay, VO2 max is going to be a big predictor of future success. If a young rider is already quite developed in their durability, or their threshold is very, very high, those are the key trainable metrics. So if they're already well developed early, you're like, okay, maybe the margin for improvement is not there. So I think the big thing that teams look for now is trainability. How can we tell if a rider is trainable? And I think for us, what we look at is basically their threshold as a percentage of their VO2 max. If their threshold is very, very close to VO2 max, it means they may be maybe close to the ceiling. But if there's a big gap between VO2 max and threshold, probably like, okay, this guy can take work. This guy has room to develop. So there's some metrics you look at, and then you watch how they develop. We look at some KPIs, we look at how they track, how they develop, if they're adapting to it at a good rate. And then we give them support that they need to ensure they can make the next step.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. I want to come back to one thing you said earlier about, we mentioned the collaboration being one of your values in the coaching group. And you said how there's this, I guess, a bit of secrecy in the cycling world, at least at the World Tour level, and people are protective of their IP coaches and maybe, yeah, teams in general. So I've always been curious about that, why that is, because in my perspective, it's not so much that there aren't really secret workouts or things like that, or programs that are perfect programs that will, you know, take a cyclist from being average to being a Grand Tour winner or something like that. So I always, and I think in triathlon especially, we have examples of quite a different culture, at least in the last five to 10 years of much more transparency in what athletes and coaches are doing. So my question to you is basically, why is there that secrecy and the protectiveness around what is done and why it's done in cycling, do you think?
Yeah, again, I suppose it's interesting for me. I've been in the cycling bubble for the last 11, 12 years, and I probably don't see it as like that. For me, it's exactly as you said. I think maybe 7, 8, 9 years ago, there was this thing about, you know, certain teams had these special workouts or secret workouts, or, you know, they had this special IP. The more I'm involved in coaching, the more you realize there is no secret training session. And I suppose I've learned that. I've been lucky enough now to work with coaches who have coached people to win, again, Roubaix and win the Giro and win green jerseys in the Tour de France. So, and you discuss with them and you're like, there's nothing special. But I think where the sport is going is that teams now are investing so much in performance, in terms of aerodynamics, in terms of performance simulations, in terms of equipment. Like, and that's where the secrecy comes, is what are people doing now in the wind tunnel, or what are people doing with this new way, like some strength work or this, you know, torque training that maybe is not so scientifically known, but teams are maybe testing certain things. So yeah, it's what I learned now, and believe me, I was that guy. I was the most protective person of my so-called IP 10 years ago. I wouldn't share. Because I've learned this myself, and I don't want anybody to know my secrets. And as you go on, yeah, there is no secrets. When you look at the sport of cycling, you need to have endurance. You need to have a good VO2 max. You need to be really durable, and you need to be able to have high sustained power. You know, if you want to follow attacks, you want to, if you're a sprinter, you want to go on the climb. So we know the demands of the race. And that's, I think, data now has allowed us to look at the demands. So there is no secrets. If we need to increase someone's sprint power, VO2 power, we can do it. So yeah, like I said, I think also as well, I think in the last few years, different conferences like the Science and Cycling Conference and a few other conferences that are around, and you see coaches are more open to sharing information. Yeah, now you do have the odd times early where people will hide things on Strava. They won't release their power files, which I understand. They won't release certain things, so you're not seeing the specific intervals that they're doing. But yeah, there's honestly, it's like I said at the start, it really is not what these guys are doing, it's how they're doing it. That's the big secret, if you ask me, how guys are really applying these sessions.
Yeah, that makes sense. So let's dive into some more specifics around training. So maybe you can start with some basics around how you coach riders. So not working with coaches, but what is your methodology there? And if you have any core training principles that are really fundamental to the way you coach.
Yeah, I think the first thing we do really is we do quite a bit of athlete profiling. So when we get a new rider in or a rider you're working, you get a bit of a profile of what they're good at, what their attributes are, and you have different attributes if they're sprinters, if they're more like classic type riders, or they're climbers, or they're certainly younger riders who maybe have we're getting more and more younger riders. I remember looking back just the last few days in the last 5 years, like we've a big increase in the amount of riders in our team, as all World Tour teams do, who are less than 21 years old. So in 2020, like our youngest rider was 23. Now we got 19. We got 5 riders under the age of 21. So again, also that takes into consideration what their training age is. So if we start with younger riders who come in, you've got to see what their training age is. Okay, what is the volume they've done in previous years, their intensity distribution. And you don't want to coach or train a 19, 20-year-old who's a neo-pro like you coach an experienced World Tour rider. Like with experienced World Tour riders now, we know that the average is guys are hitting somewhere in that 900 to just over 1,000 hours of training on the bike every year. That's not including off-bike stuff. It's around what that say, 900 to 1,000 hours. Generally in that 30,000 kilometer range, 29 if they're in more, you know, hillier climates, up to 32, 35 if they're in flatter climates, a flatter terrain, I should say, in the north of Europe. So if you have a young rider who's come in and they've done 15, 18, 19,000 kilometers, you don't say, okay, boom, let's go 30,000. So you have to have a very stepwise approach with the younger riders is taking maybe steps of, I suppose, from experience. There is no right answer, but experience is increasing by somewhere between, you know, 5,000 to 8,000 kilometers in a year. Sounds like a lot, but once you start having specific training camps and they're doing longer races, they're doing more stage races, that will happen automatically. So it's important that, for me, that's for the young guys is the most important, is really just adding volume and making them robust. In terms of the other more experienced riders, we got people who are you know, folks on GC. It goes back to the demands of the event. So I coach Felix Gall, I coach Ben O'Connor the last couple of years as well. Those two riders have objectives of to go into grand tours and fighting for podiums or top fives. So my role as a coach is not to try to improve their threshold by 5 watts. My job is to, can I get those guys closer to the demands of being a top five or top three in a grand tour? So I will coach riders based on what their objectives are. So again, if I use Felix as an example, he won't mind me saying this. Our objective last year was to be within the top five Tour de France. And he came fifth, you know, which was nice. But I coached him with the idea of, I looked at the parcours of Tour de France. I looked at the demands of the event, the different climbs, and he spent a lot of time in that 6.2 to 6.6 watts a kilo in that 20 to 40 minute range, because we knew that's what the Tour de France was going to expose him to. And that goes across again to classic riders. We know the demands of Roubaix, Flanders, Am Lopez, Nieuwsblad, and then we prepare riders. Now we've seen that in those classic races, the average speed, we know the speed goes up But we know also the intensity distribution has gone from, in the last 5 years, from 3.6, 3.7, 3.9 watts per kilo average to 4.2, 4.5 watts per kilo average, which means then guys need to do more work. So you need to be more robust to ensure that if you want to be competitive in Gent Wevelgem or E3, you've got to be able to do 4.2, 4.5 watts a kilo for 5 hours and then sprint at the end. And then we try to build that into our training. So we'll do, again, quite big camps. We'll do quite long exposures to race pace efforts or race pace intensity at periods of the year. And then we build it all as a bit of a program. So to kind of put that into context, we don't do polarize, or I don't do polarize, I don't do block. We will, I suppose, wave. We do wave periodization. That for our classic riders, right now we're in a period of polarized training. We're working on their VO2 max and their low end endurance or zone 2 endurance. When we come into January, we'll flip it, and it would be much more of a block periodization. That would be a big block where we're looking at more, like I said, race specific intensity. And the same thing applies really for the climbers and the sprinters. So that's a little bit of my philosophy is prepare the riders for the demands of their events.
And when you say that is wave periodization, where does the wave come into it? Because the description there is that you're going from more of a focus on VO2 max to race specific training, which you could also say is a bit like reverse periodization almost.
Yeah.
But is the wave that you're going back and doing the same again after the main classics goals? And
Exactly. So that's exactly what it is. So with the wave, what you do is you have periods where the two different types of trainer are almost mixed together. So we'll have periods where it's specifically polarized, and then we'll have a kind of a transition period where it's a little bit more of the lower intensity is a bit higher and the higher intensity a bit lower. Then we switch that and over then more into, like I said, the lower intensity comes even higher again. And then, we work some more on the sprint stuff. So we wave it in certain periods where they might do 2 or 3 weeks, and then there'll be a transition period, and there'll be 2 or 3 weeks of a different methodology, and then again transition period into 2 or 3 weeks of a different period as well. So what I mean by waving is also we're just adaptable as well. If we see something is working or not working, then we can stay longer in a certain period. If we see a rider is really responding to that stimulus, then we'll stay there. We'll stay there for a little bit longer to ensure that we're still maximizing their adaptations. If we see that it's not really they're not adapting well, or we're having difficulties, then we can switch it out to a different methodology for those riders. So again, it's trying to be flexible within that. And I think it's less flexible with the younger riders, where we can be quite specific with the younger riders. It's really just trying to build that volume. That's what it kind of what it is. It's much more a block periodization with younger guys, because it's much more specific, because you're really working on their physiological capacities, because they don't have the depth of work or the volume done. Whereas some of the older guys or some of the more experienced riders will, and you need to be much more, I would say, specific with the more experienced riders.
So yeah, no, that makes total sense. And with the volume then, especially for the older guys, they already have that base, but how important is it in different parts of the year?
Yeah, I think with the volume, it's really the common term I think we hear a lot is volume. I mean, and it's the big differentiator you see between U23s and World Tour. The difference is volume. You ask what is in, and volume really builds that resilience and that durability, fatigue resistance. But it's not the be all and end all. And I think we've seen some riders who maybe have gone through, one or two seasons where they've been big volumes, or and maybe not so much of the high end work, and they can really respond well to a change in that for 1 or 2 months, where we really reduce the volume, we focus more on their anaerobic capacity or their sprint capacity or their VO2 max work, and we just reduce the overall volume or the total volume. We can focus on a specific determinant of performance, and then start to layer back on the volume again. I think you can never get away with the volume. That volume is important, certainly when we look at the classics and coming into Grand Tours. But we can have windows of opportunity where we can reduce the overall volume expose them to something different. And a lot of it is now. You know, I work with a lot of guys who are living in Northern Europe where the weather now is wet, cold, and you know, we're using indoor trainers a lot. We've got guys who are racing track races. So the overall volume is quite low compared to if you live in the south of France or in Spain. But we use that period of time to focus on, again, VO2 max and anaerobic capacity, which is useful. But as we get closer to the races, again, the volume certainly builds back up.
Yeah. Is there any, you mentioned that 900 to a bit or 1,000 hours on the bike. That's, I would say, a relatively narrow range. Are there any outliers there? Some people that go a bit higher and some people that go a bit lower? Or is basically everybody, once they have reached that ability to sustain those volumes, they basically stay in that
yeah,
pretty narrow range?
There is some outliers. And again, it goes down with different teams and different runners will have different philosophies. If there really is, like I do know some coaches will really be like really high intensity, like really, really, really high intensity training, a lot of high intensity, which means the overall volume will be low. I do know of world tour riders, very good world tour riders, who are in that 600 to 700 hour range, which to some other riders may sound crazy, but they've been, you know, performing well because their training is much more, again, higher power and interval based, which can work for a certain period of time, but that also is very hard to sustain. So there is outliers there. And then you have the other people in, maybe you're in that, you know, 1100 or 1150 hours as well, where it's just volume, it's just on top of volume. And that again also can work. I think in our team, our riders I've coached, again, I've had Ben O'Connor in the past who had a very successful year last year. He was two times top five in Grand Tours and second in the World Championships. He was in around about 850, you know, which for a big GC rider is relatively low, I would say. But what he had within those 850 hours, he lives in Andorra, a huge amount of elevation. So again, he was a lot of his hours were really built on a lot of elevation meters. So there certainly is some outliers within that. But generally speaking, yeah, I said 900 to 1,000, yeah, 800, 850 up to 1,000, you know, 1,100 is the general range that you see within World Tour.
And intensity within a training week or within whatever microcycle you're using, how many intense sessions would you do in a week or in a microcycle?
I think it has increased in the last few years for different reasons. I think we've heard this before about the different, you know, recovery protocols we have and better nutrition, and riders are more focused on fueling well within sessions. Again, if we go back not that long ago, riders were maybe fueling with 30, 40, 50 grams an hour in training, whereas now it's 80, 90, 100, 120, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So riders now are much more informed of how to fuel, which then allows them to train harder. So when we speak about how much intensity we have in weeks, often it would be a minimum of two. Like in the current phase we're in now, where a lot of riders now are in this like pre-season building phase, but building volume. But we'll always certainly have some exposure to high intensity in there, be that VO2 max or be that some sprint work. So minimum two, but a lot of riders will have somewhere, yeah, three high intensity sessions a week. And what you see as well in the longer sessions, if you're doing 4, 5, 6 hours, there will be some intensity exposure within that as well. So a lot of people now will do like spiked endurance rides, will do some sprints spread out during a ride. They'll do some high intensity efforts at the back end of a ride, right at the start of a ride, when they're fresh or when they're fatigued. So yeah, intensity certainly is a bigger part of preparation now than say when it was maybe 8 or 9 years ago, where everyone just did like, you know, zone two, you don't go over 145 BPM until it's end of January. That's not the case anymore.
Those spiked endurance rides, do you include those in the 2 to 3 intense sessions, or is that small exposures in addition to the 2 to 3?
Exactly. There will be like small exposures in addition to the intensity one. So when I say an intensity session, what you with those, you're trying to expose the rider to an accumulative duration at VO2 max power, somewhere between, you know, 12 up to 20 minutes of total exposure in this period. So I think a lot of the VO2 sessions that we would do now would be, yeah, almost like we'd set up maybe 12 minutes, but 15, 16, 18 minutes of total exposure and getting up to 20 minutes of total exposure at VO2 max power. That would be an intensity session. But some of those spiked sessions we do, if guys are riding at their, you know, let's call it their zone three, whatever you want to call it, and they do the spiked effort of 20-second accelerations, they're just more exposing them to like power above VO2 max, so 600 watts, 650 watts, 700 watts. And they would be kind of, yeah, the overall accumulation of intensity is not very high, but there's exposure there always to give a different stimulus.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, that reminds me of an interview I did a few years ago now, but you probably have read the research by Nikki Winfield Almquist with those, including sprints in the endurance work, and which was quite successful. I think in that research, they didn't do the specific intense sessions, but still that's the application of science in practice, and then things look a bit different than in the research environment. But exactly. I'll link to that in the show notes for the interested listeners. Yeah, and that's what about recovery within a microcycle or within a mesocycle? How does that factor in?
That also again is a critical part. Again, we have a bit of a generic way of doing things now, that certainly in this period of the year now, we'll always have a recovery day. And it's stereotypically, it's like an hour and a half, but you know, I get guys, for me, as a coach, we often just write 1 hour, 1 hour and a half, to write. But for me, that recovery day is about the rider doing something where they're active, but it's a very low intensity. If that's 45 minutes on the rollers, if that's an hour going to the coffee shop with our mates, doing an hour and a half, that's fine. So we kind of keep the overall exposure to intensity or volume is very, very low. And then we'll also always try to have at least one full rest day. And that rest day really just allow the body to not do not be on the bike. And we do some off bike work. We'll do some, if they're doing some mobility work, some stretching work, some strength and conditioning work. We have a lot of guys now will go for a hike or go for a walk. I think one of the really, I suppose, not alarming, but interesting things is the rate or the number of professional bike riders who've got your pre-osteoporosis, osteopenia, that their bone density is not very strong. So it's a big part of us. We're looking to try to make more robust riders that we use this period now in December, certainly November, December, January, where we're promoting off-bike strength work. And you know, some load bearing or weight bearing exercises like walking, jogging, occasionally hiking to ensure also we're allowing our riders to again build their bones, which is sometimes maybe an unspoken issue within endurance sports as well, which is something that I'm quite passionate to ensure we can look after riders' health as well.
So that's within a week you would have one of those days with a short ride up to the rider and one day completely off the bike with some stimulus for bone density, walking, strength training.
Exactly, yeah. That's exactly how we would do it. And that doesn't mean that, and if there's a certain day where it's off bike and they just want to rest, and there should never be a case now where the rider is completely dead and they go, I can't move, they stay in the bed all day, they stay on the couch. Then you mean you've done too much. A rider shouldn't get to a point where they're completely cooked. I needed to sit in the couch for a whole day. So that's why we try to make sure that there's, for me, the key word is consistency. That we don't do 3 days full gas, one day they're dead, 2 days full gas, one day they're dead. It's having the consistency. But yeah, like you said, it's one day where it's really easy riding, where you can just go and relax, and one day then where, yeah, it's off bike and doing some load bearing exercise.
And do you ever do something like the 3 weeks of higher load and 1 week of deload?
I think we naturally will do this. It's not specifically set out like that. And we can make some nice graphs where you do that progressive overload and you've a week then to recover. It depends on, again, with the rider's schedule. We'll often have a slight deload, or what we call transition periods. Now I don't call it deloads, and as transition periods have gotten shorter. So we will do 3 weeks, 4 weeks of building, and maybe a 3 to 4 day transition period. And I said that transition period really is to kind of reinforce the rider. We're still got stuff to do. You know, we're focused on recovery. We're focusing on adapting or absorbing the work you've just done. We're not doing now 1 week where you can sit on the couch and, you know, eat takeaways and drink beer. But and that's just the language that we use, you know. So we use that a kind of like a transition period. But based on the rider, how much load they've done, we'll work between 3 to 4 week blocks of build into a, again, let's call it deload transition. That becomes very difficult in season. So the only time we actually can do that really is in December and January. Because once February comes, or end of January, if guys are doing Australia, you never have an opportunity to have like a 2 month phase where you can build and unload. So it becomes very much a, it might be 2 weeks build, one week of deload, or 1 week of tapering into a race. So yeah, you have to be really adaptable, and you can't follow this beautiful 3 weeks on, 1 week off when the season starts.
Yeah, so talk to me about how you do that specifically when you are in racing season, which is a lot of the year, and how what is the difference between tapering for something that is really an important race, whether it's a classics race or a grand tour, and actually maybe there's differences there in how you taper for those two, and then compared to the racing that is more part of the training almost, and what that looks like.
Yeah, no, it's one of those really interesting, difficult questions as coaches. You know, when you're involved in triathlon, you have these events, you have these kind of big events in Ironman or Olympic distance triathlon, which is your key event. You can build up, taper, and then you can be ready on that given day. With World Tour cycling now, I think having that luxury is less and less. Yes, we know the big events of the year. Milan-San Remo, Paris-Roubaix, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, Tour de France, Giro. We know the key events, Olympics, World Championships. But there's such a demand now on riders that they need to be good, or certainly they can't be, you know, bad. They need to be good almost all year. We just see certain riders who start their race season in February and they're good all the way through till October. And that's what basically now is demand of the riders. So what we will have is we'll have very mini tapers into key events. And what you try to do is before these key events, you try to balance the load with the race exposure to ensure the rider can come to a key event ready to perform at their best, but not having done a full taper where they're like peaking for this one race. I mean, to give an example, if you look at your Paris-Roubaix is a good example. You will have guys who will begin racing, they'll do a big December, big January. Then they're going to do a pre-season race like Algarve or a Route de l'Alsol. They'll go to open weekend, and open weekend, history tells us, if you're not good in open weekend, the first week of February, you're rarely good in the end of April because you've got no periods to prepare. So what they will do, Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, you do Corona Brussels Corona, you might do Paris-Nice or Tirreno Adriatico, Milan-San Remo, then you've got E3, Gent-Wevelgem, Dwars du Vlaanderen, Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix. There is no time to prepare. So you're using those races as load. And what we'll do now is we will add in quite intensive training sessions the day after certain races, like a Gent-Wevelgem, like a Dwars du Vlaanderen, to make those races blocks of training. And then for a Flanders or for a Roubaix, we will then allow the riders to have 2 or 3 easier days. Maybe 5 days out from the race, you might have 1 or 2, 2 or 3 easy days. We'll do 1 to 2 days of recon, and then we'll do a pre-race ride and then do the race. So it really is so much different than tapering for a marathon or an Ironman where you do the big, big build, then you really like drop off the volume. Intensity stays there and you carb load and et cetera, et cetera. We don't have that luxury in cycling. So it's much more of a balancing act with the riders and using races strategically to build load and ensuring that we can create freshness in the week before the race, less so having 3 days easy before Roubaix, because also we know if you take 3-4 days easy before a big event, you have this term, I feel blocked, I got blocked legs, and that is something which is kind of like this thing that riders experience where their legs aren't good or they feel, there's a number of different causes or reasons which may cause it. So yeah, we like to really give the guys some good activation the 2 days before race to ensure that they're ready to race. And if they're not fully fresh, I prefer a guy to be ready to race more than being fully fresh and almost too fresh, because that also can be not so good before a big race.
And is there any difference when you're talking about something like Tour de France, or is that very similar because you still have things like, well, you had the Dauphiné or Tour de Suisse before, and does it look, or are there any differences compared to what you just described?
It is, because with those, your preparation is either a loop camp and a stage races. So you're not having to balance 1 day race, 2 days off, 1 day race, 1 day off, 1 day race. So you can be much more consistent with your workload. Whereas in the 1 day races, it's like with those Belgian races, like I said, it's 1 day off, 2 days, you know, 1 day on, 2 days off, 1 day on, 1 day off. With the Tour de France, with the Grand Tour, it's much, much simpler. Like, to coach a Grand Tour rider really is simple. Again, like for the Tour de France, you will do your race and you'll do an Aldo camp, you maybe do Dauphiné, Tour de Suisse. Then you taper off the back of that. Then you peak down for the start of the Tour, or not the start, but maybe for whatever the key period is. And it's something that we've been lucky. We got it right in the last few years with Phoenix Garland, the Tour de France, with Ben in previous years in the Giro and the Vuelta, that they can arrive, yeah, ready to race. But it's much simpler. It's much simpler to prepare when you've a very set, yeah, continuous race and preparation periods.
Yeah, I got it. And one question that you kind of alluded to it before, but maybe if you can expand a little bit more on it. How do you determine if a rider is actually responding to the training and seeing that training is working? And if it isn't, how do you decide what changes to make to the training?
Yeah, it's another good one. I suppose, I alluded to at the start, and in not being afraid, being adaptable as coaches, not being afraid to change plan. I think what we do is we will test the riders occasionally, not all the time. One of the key things that we use to determine if it's working or not is we have subjective feedback from the riders. So we get subjective feedback from the riders in racing, or, you know, we'll do daily monitoring to see how the body is responding. But we will use testing to evaluate where the rider is, to inform what we should do, and then to, you know, track where they're going. So we'll use different forms of testing. We do the CP, the critical power W prime test, which guys don't really love because it's quite a difficult test. But that just gives an evaluation of where they are. And then we'll use sporadic lactate testing throughout the year to see, is their lactate decreased at, you know, if you in January did it a half hour climb at 350 watts, they were at, you know, 3.6 millimole. Now in March, we do the same climb, same watts, or the same intensity. And now they're at 1.8 or 1.9. So we know that they're adapting to, that they're physically getting better. So we'll use some of that during the year, along with the subjective feedback, along with their race performances. So if all that is tracking well and the subjective feedback is good, we'll continue on. What do we do if it's not working? And that's always the difficult part of it. We need to go back and reflect and see what we've done. And that's why having a group of coaches with a lot of experience, you're not just one coach with one rider. We really bring in the group together, who we've all had different issues in our career, where we have a different problems with different types of riders, and we can give each other feedback. Like, one example of me, I was a rider I worked with 3 or 4 years ago, very, very, very successful rider. He was 34 joining us, trained a certain way for all his career. And then he came to us and the team wanted him to do polarized training. At the time, it was the cool thing to do. It was the scientific thing to do, I should say, not the cool thing to do. And he trained polarized. He did no mid-range stuff. It was all easy or super hard. And he went with us, and he never gave, you know, it just didn't work. And we saw it was too late, that we'd gone in 3, 4, 5 months. He had no resistance. He had no durability. And he needed to spend time in that 320 to 360 range, which is what he always did. And then we changed it to be, okay, you're never over 280. And your hard stuff, you're always over, you know, whatever, 500 watts, whatever it was. And that's something I really learned from how the team was, and I think the rider at that time was afraid to give feedback, to say, no, I trust the team. I trust my coach. You know, I believe what we're doing. But in the end, he could have given feedback earlier and known that he wasn't feeling well. And that, again, goes back to how I discuss us as coaches. We try to ensure that we have a very open, honest relationship with the guys we coach, so they can give us honest feedback And then they say, if this is not working, they don't feel good, or they feel, oh, what about this? What about that? It allows us to make decisions much, much quicker and much, much better, which I think we've been able to do in the last couple of years.
When things are not working, do you think that, can you say that it's more commonly an issue of doing the wrong type of training, or doing not enough load, or doing too much load, or something else?
I experience tells me it's often the wrong type of training. It's what it is. It's definitely the wrong type of training, what you're trying to achieve. And then it's not knowing the rider's like physiology of like where are they already well developed? Where should we invest time to improve other parts of their physiology? And if you invest time in something that's already been well developed, the amount of, I suppose, bang for your buck, or the amount of, you know, reward you get from the investment is just not there. And what happens then is that you're like, okay, let's do more of that. And you end up doing more of that. And that just then leads then to other issues. So I think it starts off with being the wrong thing, which leads to doing too much of the wrong thing, because the answer is, well, if you're not going to, let's just do more of it. And that then you almost compound the negative response. And then that becomes, again, a big issue for the team, for the rider. I would say definitely it's doing the wrong thing, and then compound that we're doing too much of the, you know, do more of the wrong thing, I would say.
I mean, that's related to a question I find probably one of the most interesting questions to ask of other coaches, is whether to focus on strengths or weaknesses, and maybe when to focus on what, because that rider that you mentioned as an example, in that case, it was maybe that, well, actually, even though it was something that was already really well developed, that was his strength and maybe what he was naturally able to still adapt to, even if the rate of adaptation is probably much lower than at the beginning of his career, but there's still something to gain there, whereas maybe he's not able to even to benefit from another type of training. And at least I'm reading too much into that, but that's something that I've experienced with athletes before, that you think, sometimes I have thought that, well, I need to train this area of the physiology of an athlete because they haven't really worked on it and it's quite weak. But actually, I don't get any response there. And where I get a response is where they have already done a lot of work and are already strong.
It's a really good kind of philosophical way of thinking about things, because I've experienced this before as well. And you're often told, okay, do I maximize their strengths or do I focus on their weaknesses? And what I kind of do is, like, I say to myself, and I say to my coaches who I work with, is give the rider a little of what they want and a lot of what they need. If you give them a little of what they want, it keeps them motivated. It gives them exposure to what they're good at. They see nice numbers, they feel good. And you make sure you give them a lot of what they need. And a lot of what they need is building, developing their weaknesses, but building the characteristics to make them better able to meet the demands of the events they'll be racing in. And I think that's something where we can often maybe, I think with younger riders can go wrong, is that we try to develop their weaknesses. Like, for example, a rider might come and he's a very, very good climber. And then we'll just, okay, climb, climb, climb. Well, no, we got TT stuff, we got crosswinds, we got flat, we got absolute power. You know, we need to develop these things as well. But the easy thing to do is just focus on climbing, vice versa. A young guy might come who's a very, very, very good time trialist. We just go, okay, boom, wind tunnel, skin suits, TT, you know, optimization. Okay, but he also needs to improve his technical capacities, his ability to climb a little bit better. So again, for me, how I very simply in my head is that I say, give them a little bit of what they want and a lot of what they need.
Yeah, that makes sense. And also there's, with weaknesses, there's a point where the weakness is a complete limiter for the athlete to be able to achieve whatever their goals are, right? So you need to, at a minimum, get the weaknesses to a point where they surpass that level, and then it becomes more of a question of you have some more options, but at a minimum, you need to get to a certain level with all the attributes.
Yeah, I 1,000%. And again, some of my experience as well, where we might get this world-class climber in our team who's, you know, 52 kilos, 53 kilos. And, you know, in terms of on the climbing, they're incredible. But the limiting factor is their absolute power on the flat is just their key limiter. So, okay, well, what do we need to do to ensure we can at least get them to a certain point where they can exist in those flat parts? You increase absolute power. How do you do that? By, you must try to get them to increase a little bit of weight. So to go from 52 to 54, 55, 56 kilos, is just a good way to make them more robust. Yes, their WASP acuity may decrease a little bit, but if you can, like you said, you get them closer to be able to be more rounded, they can then use their attributes much, much better, because it's fine being able to do 7 watts acuity for 20 minutes. But if you're always dropped, or you can be in the front part of the peloton, you know, to be good in the climb, again, it's not really much use unless you want to race on Zwift or something, which is different. But yeah, it's a very good point, trying to at least get their weaknesses up to a certain point where they can remain competitive.
Yeah. I have a few points here that I wanted to ask you for some maybe quickfire answers, your thoughts to these concepts, these things. So the first one is indoor training in the context of the World Tour.
Used to be used just for when it was bad weather. I think now it's still used for that, but also we use it as a really useful tool, certainly with heat training, you know, exposure to heat, having a very controlled environment, do some testing as well. So everyone I coach now has a home trainer. 10 years ago, most of them didn't have one. But I think a very, very useful tool for in the World Tour, which everyone uses at strategic points during the year.
And altitude training.
Again, I would say extremely important. I think the idea around responders, non-responders is becoming more understood. I think everyone responds well. And if you can prepare well before Aldo camp, you have your iron level checked, you ensure that your health status, your iron status is well. Altitude camps become essential, I would say, to be at your peak before a Grand Tour, and it's been used more now as well by classic riders as well before big events. So our best riders will do at least one, if not two, sometimes three, but certainly 2-3 week training camps, altitude training camps during the year.
And durability?
Durability, fatigue resistance, as I call it, maybe 10 years ago. Again, we know it's a critical factor for performance in World Tour. When we look at the best riders who are winning races, their fresh power and their power after 3, 4, 5 hours or 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 kilojoules, the closer those two numbers are, the better your performance is. So durability is critical to be at the front end of bike races and certainly competing and winning with the best riders in the world.
How do you develop it?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? How you develop the durability? And it's volume. Now, that's quite interesting, because we have a young rider in our team this year, you know, which people will probably know has got not a huge amount of training history, not a huge amount of training volume, but has extraordinary durability. Therefore, there is a component as well, which is genetic. Like, there's no doubt there's a component of that is genetic, which really I didn't think was the case. For me, durability was always about volume, structural volume. So I think, number one, to build it is certainly volume. Doing efforts in a fatigued state. And then there is a genetic component as well, which I've seen firsthand this year.
Yeah, and you mentioned it before, but torque training.
Again, something which I was not a fan of 10 years ago, because I was very much a science follower. I was dictated by what science said. However, there's been new papers come out, and sometimes it's for, sometimes it's against. I think it's useful. I think even just from a structural point of view, I think it's very good for climbers that we see in certain races like the Vuelta, that we got very, very steep climbs. Having ability to produce high amounts of torque is very, very important. So it's a critical part, it's a key part of the preparation that we use for riders. We will be in the range between torque efforts between 1 up to 8 to 10 minutes, maybe at most, not beyond 10 minutes, but it's very, very rare. And certainly for sprinters, we'll do some high torque sprints and some torque sprints or overgear stuff. I think at key points in the year, we use it strategically with certain riders.
This one is not on the question sheet, but threshold training, because we talked about the polarized block that you're doing. I guess threshold training might fall into the race specific for some races, but yeah, where does that sit for you?
Yeah, I think the threshold sits into that race specific work. So when we're more in a polarized phase where it's more VO2 work or around VO2 and the lower end of endurance or zone 2, the threshold work will certainly come in around the race specific preparation. So in that, yeah, when I discussed earlier on about, you know, the classics guys are, you know, in that kind of 4 to 4.5 watts a kilo, then we'll certainly have efforts in that threshold range, which again, varies between 5 to 6 watts a kilo, 6 point something watts a kilo for certain riders. So that would be in our like our race phase, let's call it.
And in the preparation for a grand tour, is for the GC riders or anybody that needs to climb well, are those efforts basically around a critical power or so, or what? How are they structured?
Yeah, like they're basically around critical power. Also, when you analyze some of the grand tours, you can see like what I would call them preloaded efforts. So what we'll often do, you'll see the fight to get to the foot of the climb is extraordinary. And then the first 5 minutes is a VO2 max. And then they do 20 minutes at their threshold. So we will do, yes, straight threshold efforts with our climbers, but we'll also do a lot of preloaded threshold efforts where they're coming in and you're trying to create a bit of an oxygen deficit. And then you want to sit on your critical power for X duration. You know, we often work in the range of, you know, somewhere from 10 up to 22, 23, 24 minutes. So it's a little bit of straight efforts to build the physiological capacity, but then the preloaded or the spiked threshold to be more race specific, what it's like in a race, which you never rarely will do a straight up 20 minutes threshold test in a grand tour.
Yeah. So can you give an example of a session that you might give a preloaded threshold session for that purpose?
Yeah. I mean, I can use Felix as example. Last year in Altitude Camp, what we did was we did some efforts on La Plana and we did four times 24 minutes. And what it was, we did the first effort was, it was 8 minutes at 6.2, 8 minutes at 6.4, 8 minutes at 6.6 was the first effort. And then in the second effort, what we do 2 minutes at 7 watts a kilo, being 7.2. And then he would then go, so 2 minutes at 7 watts a kilo. Then he would do 6 minutes at 6 minutes at 6.2, 6 minutes at 6.4. And then we do the last effort then again, basically his feedback. He would tell me, okay, what felt good, which one would I like to do again? Now we get feedback from him. And then we make the third effort based on his feedback. But yeah, like a preloaded one really is like between 1 to 3 minutes of quite hard pace. And then we'll usually then build into a progressive ramp around critical power.
Yeah. And physiological testing versus field testing versus race data. I think you've said already that you use all three of them, but maybe elaborate on the need of all of them.
I think all three. I mean, I think the physiological test and the lab test is very, very good to evaluate kind of base physiological parameters, BMR, VO2 max, LT1, LT2 in the pre-season. So we will use lab testing in, you know, around about now, November, December. And then certainly when we get into that January, we do much more field testing. So we do the critical power tests, we do some lactate testing, but that will be predominantly done in the field. If we have a moment in the calendar where we have a block, which is very rare to have a big preparation period, we might do another lab test just to evaluate somewhere in the mid-season. But then we will often use the race data to inform us about what we should do. So yeah, like I said, all three, I would say lab in off-season, pre-season, and then field combined with race data, certainly as the season begins, just before the season starts, I should say, and during the season.
Yeah. And do you have rules of thumb or heuristics for how to train different athlete profiles and use athlete profiling?
Yeah. I mean, like I think I alluded to a little bit about young riders, certainly. We try to, I think one for me is we're coaching the rider, coaching the human being. So we had to see, we want to profile them, how they like information, how they need information. For young climbers, again, a lot of it's just building up more volume, exposing them to some threshold efforts. They usually have quite a good VO2 max being built. With classic riders, it's exposing them to the demands of the event. It's probably one of the domains within World Tour Cycling, which is probably, I would say, along with the Grand Tours, which has developed the fastest in the last, I'd say, six or seven years, just how classics are raced now. It's the same roads, the same races, but they're raced now so differently. So we just have to expose riders. Guys, this is how you guys race. So how you train 6, 7 years ago and now is a new way of doing things. So we will, again, it's really around exposing them to race efforts and race demands. And then, yeah, for me, it's really been a coach. And it's nothing against trainers. Like, trainers are very, very important, because that's when you're coaching, you're training 15, 20 riders. But for me, it's really to try to have that personal connection with the riders you coach, to kind of get their feedback. And that allows you then to really to they can guide you of what they need, and just make the overall coach-athlete relationship much more productive.
And I have some questions as well related to amateur cyclists. And I know you said before that you haven't coached an amateur in 12 years or so. So I'm sure that you have a little bit of a finger on the pulse, though, of what's around in the ether. So hopefully these questions will be still manageable for you. But how would you recommend an amateur athlete maximize their performance in the context of limited training volume? So we could call 10 to 12 hours here limited training volume, certainly compared to world tour cyclists.
Yeah, I mean, I can probably use myself as a bit of an example. I try to do a little bit more, but I think certainly when you're limited to your time crunch, as they say, trying to maximize those hours, if it's 10, 12 hours, and you always hear of these incredible triathletes who do Ironmans off kind of little volume. For me, is to try to do a little bit of what you want and do a lot of what you need. So if that means exposing yourself to, now we're in the wintertime, a Zwift race or some online race once or twice a week, just to be exposed to, I won't say unstructured intensity, I think is really quite good. Unstructured intensity can be a really nice way just to tap into those upper limits of your capacity, but then ensure you're complementing that with some lower intensity exercises or lower intensity riding. When you're training in that 10 to 12 hours, a more polarized approach will give you better bang for your buck, because it's not enough volume. If you're focused on that mid-range zone three always, it's always you're chasing fatigue. You want to chase performance, not fatigue. So don't chase the feeling of come back from a ride, come back from a run and like just be dead. That's not good. And I always wanted that fatigue and hurts and pain meant I was progressing. That's not it. Chase performance. So what I would say is, if you don't like intensity, 1 to 2 unstructured intensity sessions, i.e. Zwift race, and complement that with some good quality zone 2 lower intensity LT1 type training would be the best bang for your buck for sure.
Yeah. I have a couple of other thoughts in addition for why VO2 max training or that high intensity training is good for amateurs, even maybe, in my opinion, maybe more, even more so than for professionals, but that's in the context of triathlon, which is different, of course, than cycling. But I think that, first of all, you have a lot of athletes that are already in their, let's say, mid-30s and upwards, up to the 60s, where you already in the mid-30s or even early 30s, you might start to see a natural decline in VO2 max. So fighting that natural decline becomes more important than when you're a 25-year-old cyclist or triathlete. And then the second one is also that if you are more of an adult onset endurance athlete, you haven't gone through, your teenage years and even younger of racing and constantly exposing yourself to really high intensity, you maybe never really developed your VO2 max properly, like a lot of the athletes coming up from as young athletes did. Yep. So there's potentially more untapped potential there for that reason as well.
It's a very good point. And that's it. Like, often with more of the amateurs who maybe get into the sport later, through whatever reasons, you can probably haven't a fully developed VO2 max. So that's a place where you can get, again, good return on your investment, if you do those efforts. And also, again, for those older athletes as well, I probably class myself as one, is actually delaying the decay of your VO2 max. So we're always about, and it's not to sound negative, we're also looking to increase this, increase that, but also we can delay how something decays, and we can delay it actually, because we know as we get older, stuff decreases, your VO2 max will go down, or your endurance will decrease, different things are going to increase, and having exposure to certain intensities will just delay that, and it will make you, again, maintain your fitness at a higher level for longer. So I think those are really two good points for athletes. Yeah, certainly who got into the sport a bit later in their lives.
Do you have any other tips, irrespective of whether it's time-crunched athletes, but for amateur athletes, any other tips for how they can maximize their performance?
No, I think it's seeking out, there's so much information out there now. Is it's always good and cool to see what Pogacar does or what this person does, but not following that. I think we know recovery is going to be a big one. Sleep is a big one. Again, it's not, you know, there's no silver bullets. I think one thing I've seen with, you know, with the people and with the elites I work with is then we can optimize their sleep schedules. That just opens up a whole other, almost like, you know, box of energy that they have, that it just means you can just recover and you can be better. So to me, it's really important. We're not forgetting about sleep and recovering. Any other ones with nutrition is the same, is don't underfuel. And sometimes I alluded to the point about, you know, chasing fatigue and chasing pain. You have carbohydrates when you train. If you're on Zwift, you're doing an hour and a half, doing 2 hours, you'll consume carbohydrates. And that will have a twofold effect. One is your session will be better, and you'd be less hungry afterwards, because we all know the feeling. You go and you bash yourself for 2 hours and you get off and boom, fridge opens and you're like, okay, I've done 2 hours there, for now I can attack the fridge. And that really is something that I know in when I was, you know, certainly trying to be fit again was not being afraid to fuel during your session, which means then you can be more controlled after your session as well. So I think those are, I think, two or three ones which I think are good things to follow.
Yeah, great. And yeah, I think that's it for the amateur questions. I just have a few more reflective questions for you. And the first one is, what advice would you give to your younger self at an earlier point in your career?
Learn French. I think it's interesting. When I reflect back on how I got to where I am, I think everything I did had an impact on where I am now. I think if I did certain things differently, I wouldn't be where I am now. But yeah, I mean, if I reflect now, I would think, yeah, being, I suppose, expose myself to more sports earlier. I was very, I come from a small village in Ireland where I only ever knew one sport and did one sport from the age of 6 to the age of 22. And I probably regret a little bit not being able to expose myself to endurance sports or different sports, and then to improve different aspects of my motor skills, to see what I was actually capable of doing. So that would have been one. But I think everything else was in terms of my understanding, my knowledge. I traveled, I got to see different things, was quite good. But yeah, maybe those are my two. Learn French and be more, do different sports when I was in my teens.
And is there something that you're trying to learn more about at the moment or recently or focusing on in your development?
How Pogacar goes so fast. It's a cool question, because for me, what keeps me going is trying to, you know, really prepare riders to match the demands of racing and what actually is possible. And I think, you know, 15 years ago, I was a physiology nerd and I was a science nerd and I read all my physiology books and I got into coaching. I maybe fell out of that for the last 6 or 7 or 8 years. And now what I'm seeing now, the numbers that guys produce and the capacity that guys can get to, I'm like, well, everything that I learned, you know, 15 years ago actually is not true, because the ceiling is so much higher than what we thought. So for me now really is trying to go back and look at what actually is possible. Like, what is physiologically possible? Like, how can we prepare athletes to really get to the peak of their genetic potential? I think we're breaking new ground within sports, across all sports. You know, it's getting faster every single year. So kind of, it's why I'm doing this. I was a podcast. I used, you know, listen to podcasts morning, noon, night, read books. And yeah, I kind of fell out of that in the last few years. So now I'm getting back into reading, listening to other experts, reading more books, reading more papers, asking more questions. And yeah, just trying to be a better coach as well.
So I have a couple of follow-up questions on that then. So first of all, what were the limits that you learned about when you were studying physiology and that you thought, or that the physiology books at the time thought that we had?
Yeah, I think it was a lot of around with me. If I'm looking at power numbers, it was stuff around like power VO2 max and what was possible. We heard of your power threshold as 5 watts a kilo was good, and VO2 max was 7 watts a kilo was good. Whereas now, those two numbers are completely, like, not even close. Like, now, if you don't have a threshold of 6 watts a kilo, I mean, you're not in first, second, or third group in a grand tour. My VO2 max, the numbers we see now are so much higher than what you know, certainly I learned about what I was doing, you know, when I was a bike rider. Also is what the volume of work that athletes can take, like the overall volume and the amount of work that the athlete can take. We always had heard, you know, certainly when I was in university, you know, that you had to have always, you know, 3 rest days. You could only train for a certain amount of hours because your body needed to absorb. You couldn't tolerate doing a 20-hour week or a 25-hour week or a 30-hour week. And then also the other one is the whole nutrition stuff that, you know, not so long ago, 60 grams an hour was seen as the peak amount of carbohydrates you could consume, or you could oxidize per hour. And now we see that's not only doubled, it's doubled and some. So, which is, and that's what's cool about this, being involved in this sport. I know I'm in a very privileged position that I have access to the best subjects probably in the world, and we can see what they can do, how they do it. And yeah, I'll rewrite a physiology book in the future years to go back when I go back lecturing in a few years' time to rewrite what the athletes actually can do.
So this might be an obvious answer to this question, I guess. But do you think it's possible for somebody else than, let's say, Vingegaard has been the one challenging? But is it possible for somebody like Felix Gall or some of the other protagonists on the other teams to actually challenge Pogačar in next 1, 2, or 3 years, if we assume that he keeps being as good as he is, so there's not a decline on his part, but can others rise to that level?
Honestly, I think so. I do think we'll see the gap close in the next 1 to 3 years. I do think, and I think, you know, there's no doubt he's been exceptional. Like, and not just in the climbs and the Grand Tours, you see him in Flanders, in Roubaix, in Strade Bianche. I mean, he's just the complete bike rider. So he's all aspects of him as a bike rider is just incredible. And I've got nothing but respect of how he does it, and I mean it's incredible. It gives us all rest of us motivation to know what is possible. But I do think that the gap will close in the next 2 to 3 years because there's more young riders coming, and I think the overall knowledge compared to now than maybe there was 5 years ago, 6 years ago when Pogačar was coming through was maybe not as let's say robust, whereas now, yeah, you see all these different, you know, superstar riders that are coming through. But I do think the gap will close. The caveat is how long will these young superstars be in the sport? Will they be in the sport for 2, 5, 10 years? That's the unknown question. And something I'm also very conscious about, that, yeah, we're seeing now 19, 20 year olds who are incredibly talented. Will they still continue to progress into their, you know, late 20s, early 30s? Again, it's very, very hard to know, but I've no doubt we'll see a 20-year-old, a 21-year-old winner of a Grand Tour in the next 2 to 3 years for sure.
Mm. And yeah, I have one final follow-up on this, or kind of related really, but when we think about the physiology of somebody like Pogačar, one thing that springs to mind is before the Paris Olympics, there was this video with Christian Blumenfeld doing a VO2 max test, and I think the numbers were something like 7,800 milliliters per minute. So that would have translated to a little bit above 100 normalized for body weight. So, I mean, my first instinct when I saw that, and it hasn't really changed, is that, well, that's just, the equipment is just not well calibrated, no matter how much they claim that it was, it was a legit test and legit calibration of the equipment. So the question, I guess, is, how much does it help to have physiological data if you could have all Pogačar's physiological data to actually try to, I guess, replicate that versus it's just the speed that you're seeing, and at the end of the day, the watts per kilogram to go up a climb at a certain speed. Like, do you need to know the VO2 max? Do you need to know the glycolytic power? Do you need to know all of that? Or is it more about reverse engineering the watts per kg?
That's it. It's reverse engineering, and I think it's because it's a bit of a topic at the moment. I think the VO2 max of Pogačar, it doesn't matter if it's 90, 95, 98, 100, whatever. It actually doesn't matter. It is whatever it is. It's set, and I think it's more about, like I said, I've coached riders who have followed him for a short period of time in climbs, and I've seen power they're doing on his wheel. So like I can then reverse engineer what he's doing, or what, you know, in round what he's doing. And that then is the target. Like that's what he's doing. Therefore, you can. So I've been, like I said, lucky enough. Ben O'Connor last year, the Giro, you'll follow Pogacar for a couple of hundred meters and then blew up on one of the climbs. So, I mean, I could see what he was doing. Same with Felix Gall. Yeah, again, a couple of years ago, this year, there was a little bit where he followed a little bit so you can see what he's doing. And you can reverse engineer to see what they're doing now. And the numbers are extraordinary. Like, the numbers are extraordinary. What Felix did this year, what he did 3 years ago, they're worlds apart. Like, he's taken a huge step forward. Again, still the best guys still stay ahead of the game. But yeah, like I said, for me, like with the Blumenfeld stuff, yeah, obviously the machine was not very well calibrated. But with Pogacar, like I said, it's about reverse engineering, because he's an athlete. We're racing. In my world, we're racing him. I'm not there to improve Felix Gall's threshold by 5 watts or 10 watts. It doesn't matter. I'm here to prepare him to race against Pogacar or Vingegaard or whoever it may be. And that's how I look at it.
Yeah. And let's do the final reflective question, which is, what is the best or most influential book that you've read?
Yeah, I mean, I used to read a lot. I think one book, which I suppose I read maybe quite a few years ago, and that was called Pebbles of Perception. And it's a book that was recommended to me by a rugby coach. And the general idea around it was to how to ask better questions and be more curious. And what it does, it gave me a bit of a framework to be confident in my decision making. That as a coach, we make hundreds of decisions every day. Let's choose this session. Let's use this periodization. Let's have a rest day here. So we make all these decisions. Sometimes you second guess yourself, but the book kind of paints a context of, if you're asked good questions, it gives you the guardrails to be confident in the decisions that you make. And I've taken so much. Now, for me, if I make a right decision or a wrong decision, if I understand why I've come to that decision, for me, I feel quite comfortable. Even if it fails, but I take the correct steps to make that decision, I'm super comfortable. And that's really given me a lot of confidence, in how I speak to riders, how I make decisions. We live in quite a chaotic environment where you have to act very, very quickly. Often you don't have a time to analyze and to check and to make a nice action. Often it's just you have to act quite quickly. And so with that book, Pebbles of Perception, is just one which kind of sprung to mind of, gave me the confidence to be confident in my decision making.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Is that written from is it behavioral psychology or is it management?
I think he's actually, if I'm not wrong, I don't want to say if I'm wrong, but he's a behavioral psychologist, but I think he's like a Swedish author. The name is in my head, but I'm afraid to say it because in case I'm wrong. But yeah, it's around about that, because it's about the whys and the whats and the hows. But it's very easy to apply it to sport, because I've read some of those books before and I've kind of done a chapter. I'm like, okay, this is not for me. It's too far away from sport. But yeah, a friend of mine who's a rugby coach recommended it to me, and again, I took it on, and it was really, really quite good.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Stephen. This has been a fantastic chat. I really enjoyed it. And I wish you all the best and the entire team for the season ahead, even though we're only in December. But I guess the work is going on at full steam right now to have a successful 2026.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks a lot. I appreciate the invite. It's been nice to talk and share some ideas. And thanks again. Been really good to chat.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. You can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com/672. And in the podcast app, wherever you listen to this episode, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Pocket Cast, and so on, if you scroll down in the description of the episode to the section, what should I listen to next? I have added a bunch of related episodes that I think you'd really like. So, and this is something I do for every episode. You can always go and check out that section if you're running out of content to listen to. In this case, I have a bunch of interviews with cycling coaches and cyclists that if you enjoyed this episode, you'll love those as well. Before saying goodbye for this week, I want to quickly remind you that if you are looking to take your triathlon performance to the next level, and this is no matter whether you're a fast athlete, a slow athlete, a beginner, or an experienced athlete, at Scientific Triathlon, we help athletes of all levels improve their performance through smart, holistic coaching, focusing on the individual and the individual's needs. We are a scientific triathlon, so of course we place a lot of importance on making sure that we use what we know from science, but also all of our coaches are also athletes themselves, and we really understand the practical side of things, and we make sure to also lean into this and make sure that the program is based on both sound science, but also sound coaching and training practice. And the key thing is, of course, consistent observation and communication. So we keep tweaking the plan to make sure that the athlete is improving. And we started working with quite a lot of new athletes in the last couple of months. And I've heard from a few already that they're super happy with the coaching and the improvement so far. And the only regret is not starting sooner. So again, if you want to take your performance to the next level in 2026, go and check out scientifictriathlon.com/coaching, read about how things work, and then email me to set up a discovery call or to ask questions and learn more. We would love to work with you towards your goals in 2026 and beyond. And finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelhydration.com. If you're looking for high quality, practical and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel Hydration. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS2025. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.